Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a PhD holding historian, a professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that makes legit, seriously researched American history come to life through entertaining stories. Join me for a chronological telling of the United States story, from the Revolution to fractious Civil War, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way from 1776 to the early 20th century. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on Spotify.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. Say, a quick reminder, I do have a sister podcast, and there are interviews over there, too, if you need a quick fix. In my most recent episode of Minnesota's Most Notorious, Where Blood Runs Cold, I talk with Tim Mahoney about the Barker Karpus Gang, one of my favorite subjects of all time, and their notorious time in St. Paul. So on to today's interview. I am so glad to have journalist and author Marty Link back with me. We spoke almost 3 years ago about her wonderful book, Isidore's Secret, Sin, Murder, and Confession in a Northern Michigan Town. For those who don't remember, it was about the murder of Sister Yanina, a young nun in 1907, Isidore, Michigan. One of my top favorite books I've ever read for this podcast, by the way. She's here today to talk about another great book, this one called When Evil Came to Good Heart, an Up North Michigan Cold Case. Thanks so much for joining me. So great to have you here again.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me back. And of course, for those kind words about Sister Yanina.
Oh, absolutely. So you are releasing a spring anniversary edition of your book, right?
Right. It's been out for a couple of weeks now. And it the very first book was published in 2008. And so the press actually approached me and they said, we know that you continue to get correspondence about the Goodhart case, and we know that you're still in communication with some of the retired detectives. So would you like to put an afterword and have us release a 10th anniversary? So I said yes and started. I don't want to necessarily say I researched the case anew, but really that's what happens when you revisit something that you wrote. You know, you tend to get drawn back in really easily.
Oh my gosh, I just realized I have the older edition of your book. I'm looking forward to hearing about the afterword.
That's all right, you can ask. I mean, it's 10 new pages, and pretty much it talks about things that I've learned since the book was published in 2008, and whether or not it's appropriate to point fingers 50 years later.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to hear more. So when did you first hear about these murders?
I was pretty young. I grew up in Michigan. I was born in Detroit, grew up in some of the southern Michigan suburbs. And when I was 8, we were invited for the first time to a cottage that had been in our family for years, but we were kind of the shirt tail relatives. And a distant aunt said that we could come up and see the cottage. So I was eight. I was very excited about this trip. My brother and I were in the back seat of the car. My parents were in the front seat. And my dad was listening to the Tigers on the radio. And later on in the drive, we were driving from Bay City to the northeastern part of the state. There was a radio announcement, and it said that a family of six had been murdered inside their cottage and that the killer was still at large. That's all I remember from that time being eight. But I remember the feeling of thinking, here I am on my way to our cottage, and a family had just been killed in their cottage. Now, unbeknownst to me, it wasn't anywhere near in the geography. It wasn't close. Goodhart is not close to where the family cottage is. But when you're eight, you don't know that. And so that feeling and that moment stuck with me for a long, long time. And when I was back in Michigan, I had lived on the East Coast, and I came back to Michigan, and I thought, hey, I wonder if there's a book about that family. I'm really curious whatever happened. And there was no book. So I guess if I have any advice for any potential true crime writers out there, it's write the book that you want to read. Because, you know, if we're interested in something, chances are there's going to be other people out there too who have the same interest. So that's how my research started. I already had some newspaper clippings that I had saved over the years just because I was intrigued by the case. And that's kind of, you know, it was maybe 10 years of research, unbeknownst to me, that I was doing. You know, I was just kind of collecting these clips.
So Goodhart, tell us about the place, if you would. Maybe a little bit about its history, what kind of effect these murders had on the town.
I've been all over my native state. I like to fish, I like to boat, I like to camp, I like to hike. And Goodhart has to be one of the most beautiful places in the entire Lower Peninsula. It is a small town on a bluff at the northern end of what's called the Tunnel of Trees. So there's a highway called 119, and it's a windy highway from Harbor Springs to Goodhart. And then it goes a little further to cross a nearby town called Cross Village. This is in the northern Lower Peninsula on the western side, and it's north of Petoskey. So that would probably be the biggest town that people would recognize. Off to the west is Lake Michigan that you can spy as you're driving along the Tunnel of Trees. You catch glimpses of Lake Michigan, and then the trees kind of envelop you again, and you go around a big curve, and then there's another glimpse of Lake Michigan. It's just a spectacularly beautiful place. It has a lot of native history. There were many really important council meetings among various bands of Native Americans throughout history. There's a council tree nearby. There are Indian legends that get kind of traded back and forth even today. So it's just a really remarkable, remote, and pretty magical place, actually.
What an idyllic sounding place. It makes it even more stunning, I suppose, that something so horrific could happen in such a pleasant, lovely town.
Yeah. Michigan has this sort of myth of up north. You know, we think of up north as the place to go to get away from it all. So even growing up, a lot of kids we're going to go to camp up north, or we're going to go on vacation up north. Up north for people who live in Michigan is kind of thought of as an escape. And so the idea that something as heinous as this would happen up north, it doesn't square. You know, it's hard to understand because a lot of people in Michigan think that those kinds of crimes are limited to the urban areas and that nothing like that should ever happen in the Northwoods. Well, you know, obviously it does, but it was pretty shattering when it happened.
Could you tell us about the Robison family, who they were and what they were doing there in June of 1968?
So the only photograph I have of all six members of the Robison family. They're all dressed up. All the boys have dark suits on and ties that match their father's. And the mother has on a dress and a lapel pin. And the daughter is also wearing a dress. And I find that so appropriate because they were a rather formal family. Richard Robison had an advertising and public relations business in Southfield, Michigan. The family lived in Lathrop Village, which was a nearby town. And both of these places were suburbs of Detroit. And he was a patron of the arts. He was an amateur painter himself. He also published a magazine about art activities in the Detroit area. And he was extremely demanding of his family and also of his employees. So when I look at that kind of that picture, the Christmas photograph that was taken in 1967, the year they were all killed, and they're all looking so formal and so kind of frozen in time, it seems appropriate because they were that sort of very reserved and formal family. So Richard and Shirley were just about to celebrate their 20th wedding anniversary in 1968. Their youngest daughter was Susan. She was 8, same age as I was when I was in that car on my way to our family cottage. The two older boys, Richie Jr. and Gary, almost looked like twins. And then their middle brother, Randy, was 12 years old in 1968 when the crime took place. Gary is the one that kind of always pulled at my heartstrings when I was doing my research because he was the troublemaker from what I've heard from people who knew the family. If anybody was going to step out of that family straitjacket, it was going to be Gary. And maybe later when we talk more about the actual crime, I can tell you a detail about him, you know, why he pulls on my heartstrings. But that's the family in a nutshell.
So how were the police notified something was wrong? It was still in June, right?
It was in July. The family was killed in June. But that's one of the more disturbing things about the crime is that it was almost a month before anybody realized that it had happened. The family had told their friends and their relatives that they were going away on a trip. And actually, they found suitcases all packed at the crime scene. And so they thought that they were going on a trip. And back in 1968, we didn't have constant communication with our friends and our relatives. So it didn't seem unusual when a few weeks went by and nobody had heard from the family. So by the time their bodies were discovered, almost a month had gone by. So it was a very difficult crime scene, not only to just have to experience as a police officer, but also to have to do any investigating because there was little that hadn't been degraded.
Who found the bodies?
Well, Goodhart is there's a little resort community there that's down by the water. And that was where the Robison's cabin called Somerset was located. And about 100 yards down the shore, there was another family there vacationing. And the woman was having a bridge party. So she was having some of her friends over and they were playing bridge. And they started to complain about the smell. And so they called the caretaker of the resort to go check and find out where the smell was coming from. And he located it at the Robison cottage and eventually broke in the door.
Was this the kind of place where people just kind of checked in and stayed to themselves? Was there a reason no one noticed that there had been no activity coming from their cottage?
Well, I think the strange thing was both of their cars were still in their driveway and covered with pollen. So it looked like the cars had been there for quite some time. Now, keep in mind, even though this is a lakeshore resort, it's still in the pines. So the woods are very thick right up to the beach. So there was a lot of pine pollen on the cars. But there was also a note taped to the outside door that said, "We will be back on July 13th. So nobody thought much of it. I mean, they thought, well, they've left a note. And yes, their cars are here, but the Robinsons were known to take private airplanes when they traveled. So I think people probably just assumed they had gotten a ride to the Harbor Springs Airport and they had gone on their planned trip via air travel.
Once the authorities arrived, what did they find? What was the crime scene like?
I can't imagine what must have gone through the minds of the detectives and the officers who responded, because you could work three careers on three lifetimes in this area and never see a crime of this magnitude in this part of Michigan. The drapes had all been drawn. The doors had all been locked. The windows had all been locked. And whoever killed the Robinsons turned up the heat inside the cottage. The cottage was filled with flies. Richard Robinson was on the floor in the hallway. Shirley Robinson was on the floor in the living room. Richie and Randy and Susan were in the hallway. And then what really got me is that the family had one gun. They owned one gun. It was a .22 that they just used for chipmunks or squirrels that were around the cottage. And they kept it in a back room on the top shelf in the closet. And Gary was found in that room near the closet with his arms on the floor, but with his arms raised over his head. So all I can imagine is that here's this kid who was always getting in trouble, as much as you could get in trouble in that family because they kept things pretty buttoned up. And yet he's also the one with the presence of the mind to try to go for the gun. I just can't get that out of my mind.
Yeah, that's just horrifying. What evidence did they collect at the scene of the crime?
Well, the family had been shot with two separate guns, and it looked like there were holes in one of the outside windows. So they had been shot at with a rifle from outside the cottage, and then somebody, whoever that person was, then ran inside the cottage with a Beretta handgun. So they recovered shell casings. That was their main form of physical evidence. The only other thing of any use was a bloody footprint in the wood floor of the cottage, and they actually got a skill saw and cut that piece of the flooring out and preserved it as evidence.
Did the police focus on the resort itself for a while, or did they expand their search pretty quickly?
Well, initially they knocked on doors to ask if anybody had seen or heard anything. And someone said, well, yeah, we heard a bunch of gunshots on about a month ago in the evening, but we thought it was teenagers shooting seagulls. And so that's how that helped them narrow down when the crime actually took place. Of course, they talked to all of the other resorters, but pretty quickly they spread out and spoke with a lot of people in Emmett County, which is where Goodhart is. And about an hour and a half south in Traverse City, there was a rather large mental institution, the state hospital. And so they interviewed a number of people at the state hospital. Then the investigation expanded to Detroit because that was where Richard had his business and that's where the family lived. They also even looked at CMU because Richie Jr. was about to be a college student, and they thought, well, maybe he could have got in the wrong way with somebody at college. I mean, they exhausted pretty much every avenue. They looked at the mafia. I mean, really, they left no stone unturned. But it became evident quickly when they looked at bank records that Richard Robinson was probably the target and the rest of the family were what it says in the police report is collateral damage. So Richard was the main target, and the motive, it looked like to police, was money, because he had about $200,000 that he was expecting on an investment, kind of like venture capital, and that money never materialized. So they knew from his correspondence that he was expecting that money. They knew that he had made about a dozen phone calls to one of his colleagues in the days before the murder, and that money was missing.
Whose jurisdiction did this fall under? Was it the state police, the county sheriff?
Originally, it was the Emmett County Sheriff. Now, to add insult to injury on how hard this case was to investigate, the sheriff at the time was a man named Richard Zink, who was beloved in Emmett County. He was very good at his job. People liked him. He was always working. And he had been the sheriff for a dozen years. When the Robisons were killed, he had taken his family out to Yellowstone on his first family vacation since becoming sheriff. So almost a decade had gone by since he had had a vacation, and just by chance, he decided to take a vacation during the same time that the Robison crime took place. So he was all the way out in Yellowstone, and he was walking to his car, and somebody noticed that he had a Michigan license plate when he was in Wyoming, and they walked up to him and they said, "Hey, did you hear about that crime in northern Michigan?" And that's how he learned that there was this huge crime, this murder of an entire family right in his backyard when he was out of town. So he packed up his family and hightailed it back to Michigan. In the meantime, Richard Robison's colleague, a man by the name of Joe Scalero, had chartered a private plane and flown to northern Michigan and demanded to meet with the sheriff. And so he met with the sheriff, the prosecutor at the time, a guy named Dick Smith. He also attended that meeting. And when that meeting was over, they both had a chill. They both said, "Something's wrong with that guy."
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilly, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day, 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the golden age of piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories? Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
What do you think this guy's motive was? Was he just a narcissist, an attention seeker, or was he trying to shift suspicion from him by being so open?
You know, he's a complex he was a complex person. So I think it's probably a combination of all of those things. And I also think that he was extremely intelligent, but I also think he had an inflated idea of how intelligent he was. And I think he got a little thrill going up and knowing, you know, here I am, the person responsible, and I'm going to snow these people. I'm going to snow these Northwoods backwoods sheriffs.
Can you talk a little bit more about this guy, Scalero? His background, how he found himself in business with Mr. Robison. What was his character like?
Yeah, so Joe Scalero he had the heart of a salesman. And he and Richard came to the attention of each other at a business function. And Richard offered him a job to come and work for him as a subcontracting salesman. Now, this is just a little aside. People ask me after they read the book, so you think the business partner did it? And it just grinds me that they call him the business partner, because he wasn't a partner. He was a subcontracting salesman. So I always try to make that clear. You know, I don't want to give him any more authority than he deserves. So he had worked for Richard for about a year and a half, and Richard was really smart, and he had really, really great business acumen. And in 1967, he came up with this idea that he wanted to build central warehouses that would have easy access to airports and where people could order things over the telephone and have them mailed to their houses and have these warehouses all over the country. I mean, it's kind of incredible. It sounds a little like Amazon without the internet. And yet it was his idea, and he had some plans drafted up for this back in 1967. And that's what he was looking for capital to do. He wanted investment to do this. And Joe Scalero had told him that he would help him. He would help him get some investment. He also was selling advertising space in Richard's magazines. And Richard liked him and trusted him and confided in him. And so the summer of 1968, Richard's business was doing reasonably well. He had Joe Scalero to run things. And so it was going to be the first time in his family's life that he could afford to take the entire family to Goodhart for the whole summer. Instead of just going up there for weekends or instead of just going up for a week, the family had planned to spend the whole summer in Goodhart. And to Richard, that was kind of a signifier that he had made it. You know, that was something that he had always wanted to do, and here he had accomplished it. Well, as soon as the family left, business checks started disappearing. Joe Scalero's suddenly salary was doubled. His per diem and his expense account was dramatically increased. And none of these things did Richard approve. It was just almost from the day he left town, Joe Scalero started ripping him off.
How was Scalero able to access his accounts?
Well, just imagine again that this is in the 1960s when, you know, you can't go online to check your bank account. And even today, if you go to the spot where the Robison Cottage once stood, your cell phone won't work. So sometimes they couldn't even make calls from their landline inside the cottage. They would have to go to a neighbor's. So I think Richard probably took the idea that he was on vacation seriously, and he wasn't calling his banker every day. There were a flurry of calls, though, between Richard and his banker on the day before he and the family were killed. And the banker told him, I know you said that you were going to get that $200,000 investment check, but it's not here. That money hasn't been deposited. And then the banker said, but there are all these checks that we've paid, you know, signed by Joe Scalero.
How did the police actually link Scalero to this embezzlement scam? Were they able to follow a paper trail and eventually link him to the money?
They were. They did take a look at the canceled checks. They talked with the president of the Bank of Detroit, and he opened up all of Richard's business and personal accounts, so they were able to track the money that way. And then they talked with the banker that Richard had said, well, where is that $200,000? And he said, well, it isn't here. And Richard was furious. So, and Richard told the banker, well, my next call is going to be to Joe Scalero, and he better tell me what happened to that money. So that was a pretty big indicator of who the police needed to look at. Then they also interviewed some of Scalero's friends, and he owed many of them money. And that was a red flag to them as well. Interestingly enough, though, Joe made himself very available to the police for interviews. He did not seek out an attorney. He went into the police station 3 or 4 times for interviews. He was polygraphed a couple of times, every time of which he failed. But he had this idea that he didn't need an attorney, that he could be his own attorney, or he was just so intelligent and so crafty that the police would never catch him out and would never be able to get him to confess. He was quite enamored with his own intellect.
And the police were aware of this, right? They were on to him pretty early.
I think they were on to him pretty early. This was such a high-profile crime that the Michigan State Police assigned 2 detectives full-time to work this case only. And Emmett County Sheriff's Department was still gathering leads up in northern Michigan, but they didn't have the capacity to, you know, they didn't have a mobile crimes lab. They didn't have 2 full-time detectives to look into the case. So pretty soon it was Michigan State Police was in charge, with Emmett County giving what assistance they could. And these 2 detectives, Stearns and Fliss, would just follow Joe around. He had a car. They knew what he drove, and they would just follow him around Detroit. And if he was going into the dry cleaners to get his suit, or if he was stopping somewhere for lunch or stopping somewhere for a drink after work, they would just show up and say, "Hi, Joe." They just wanted him to know that they were always watching. It had to be incredibly intimidating for Joe, but I've seen the surveillance photographs, and he looks completely relaxed and confident in all of them.
You write in your book that the police found him a little off, right? A little bit weird.
Yeah, he talked very fast, and his story changed, and I think probably the biggest red flag was they broke his alibi. So his alibi for the time of the murder was that he was at Cobo Hall in Detroit going to a convention. And he did go to a convention, but it was the day before the murders, not the day of. And so police were able to break that pretty quickly. And the day of the murders, not only did he have no alibi, but when they interviewed his wife, she said he had left early in the morning. He was gone all day, and she doesn't know where he was, and he didn't get back until after midnight. So that was enough time to drive from Detroit to Goodhart and back.
How did his wife handle these accusations?
She does not appear much in the police report. She was not interested in being interviewed by me, which is certainly understandable. She's really distanced herself, from what I can tell, from this. And yet, the one interview that she did give to police, you can tell she loved her husband.
Were there any other suspects, or was it only him once they'd discovered this connection?
Among Stearns and Fliss, there were no other suspects. Once they had done several interviews with Joe, they were convinced that he was their man. Publicly, they didn't say that, of course. But publicly, all sorts of tips were coming into the police. And also, at that time, the Detroit Free Press had this tip system where people could call in and give a tip, and if it turned, you know, it was like a Crime Stoppers. If it turned out to be something helpful, they could get money. So all kinds of tips are in the police files. Everything from really super bizarre stuff to my neighbor. You know, it was my neighbor. So the police checked all of those out, but they were pretty convinced that they had their man. Now, just to maybe jump forward a little bit, on the 50th anniversary of this crime, we had a forum with one of these detectives, Lloyd Stearns, and also Ron Kovalt, who was the assistant district attorney in Oakland County at the time, and Dick Smith, who was that prosecutor at the crime scene back in 1968. And it was in front of a rather large audience in Northern Michigan in an auditorium. And I was moderating, and I sat down with a pile of notes. And those three men didn't have any notes, and they remembered the crime like they investigated it yesterday. And they were unanimous in their surety that Joe Scalero killed the Robison family and that he acted alone.
What a treasure trove of firsthand accounts, interviews.
Yeah, and it was really humbling to be in their company, and also just amazing their recall of the case. I think that just underscored what an impression it made on them. And I am still in touch with some cousins and surviving family members of the extended Robison family. And I said to them, you know, this shows you how much people in Northern Michigan and also the officers that investigated what happened to your family, how much they really care about you and about a final answer, bringing you a final answer.
What about the footprint? Were they able to match that bloody footprint to Scalero?
Yeah, another puzzle, because this case is full of them. Joe Scalero was known as a guy, if he bought a suit and he really liked it, he would go back to the store and buy another one. He liked to have two of everything. Now, when the footprint was cut out and it was examined by the crime lab, the Michigan State Police Crime Lab, they said, this looks like it was made by a dress shoe that had a rubber put over it. So, you know, back in the 60s in Detroit, when you were a well-dressed man and you were going out on a sales call or something, and it was bad weather, you would wear your nice shoes, but then you would put a rubber over them. So they thought that that's what made the footprint. When they went to Joe Scalero's house, they found the exact size and pair of shoes that could have made the mark, the exact pair of rubbers that could have made the mark in the right size, but each of them were brand new in the package, never been opened. When they determined what the murder weapons had been, an AR-7 and a Beretta handgun, they also found through the records of gun purchases that Joe had two AR-7s and two 25 caliber Berettas. One of each was missing. So he was a man that bought two of everything. And yes, they matched the guns and they matched the footprint to Joe, but only in you know, that was the type, but not the actual one. So they did get a break in the case, finally, after a year and a half of investigating. Stearns and Fliss were dogged, and they were not going to give this case up without a solution. And so in 1967, a year and a half after the crime, when everybody else was having their turkey dinner on Thanksgiving weekend, Stearns and Fliss learned that Joe Scalero's father-in-law had a gun range that the family used to target shoot. And they thought, why don't we go check there? Why don't we check to see what we can find? And so over Thanksgiving Day weekend, they made a grid with stakes and string all over that target shooting range. And they each took metal detectors and they went over the whole place and collected as many shell casings as they could, brought them back to the Michigan State Police Crime Lab. And lo and behold, some of those shell casings matched the shell casings found at the Robison family crime scene.
Incredible. Were they ever able to find any fingerprints?
No, no fingerprints on anything.
So was this enough evidence to build a case around?
Well, the detectives certainly thought so, and they wrote out their findings, not just the ballistics evidence, but all of their findings in a 131-page report that they delivered to the Emmett County prosecutor. Now, by now, that person was no longer Dick Smith, because he had run for judge and won. There was a new prosecutor. His name was Don Nagel. He worked part-time, and they delivered their report to him, and they said, we expect a warrant. We think there's enough here for a warrant. So Christmas went by, New Year's went by, and finally in early January, Don Nagel decided, no, he didn't have enough to arrest. Now, my research has uncovered that that was not necessarily just his decision. Emmett County commissioners said, we don't want a trial here unless it's a slam dunk. We can't afford it. We don't want the publicity. We don't want to spend the money. So unless you can put Scalero at the scene of the crime, at the time of the crime, with the weapons, we will not authorize a warrant. And so he was never arrested.
And you find that strange, right?
I do. I mean, at the very least, impanel a grand jury. At the very least. But there, I've read that 131-page report several times, and there's enough. Not only is there enough to arrest, there's enough to convict.
And this was one of the most talked-about murder cases in the area for years.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, definitely.
You'd think with that kind of publicity and such a harsh spotlight that police and prosecutors would go out of their way to make sure there was a trial.
Well, I also think that their concern was, we're a tourist town. We don't want people thinking that that happens up here. So they let that take precedence over getting justice for an entire family, which is really reprehensible.
A conviction would take a murderer off the streets. You'd think in a touristy area, especially, it would only ease minds.
Right, right. Well, it'd be an accomplishment for them, for their, you know, their legal department and their police department. And it certainly wasn't a decision that that sat well with the sheriff, but it was out of his hands.
So then what happened to the case? Did the investigation continue?
Stearns and Fliss continued to do some investigating, but they no longer had the luxury of only working on this case. So they had other crimes also that they were investigating at the same time. So a few years went by, and then a man by the name of Ron Koval, who was an assistant district attorney in Oakland County at the time and a pretty brilliant legal mind, he went to the new administrator of Oakland County and the prosecutor in Oakland County, a guy named Brooks Patterson, and said, look, I still think there might be a way to arrest this guy. Even though the crime happened way up north in Emmett County, it was planned here in Oakland County, and the weapons were probably purchased here in Oakland County. And so I say we arrest him. I say we try and convict him. We're better financed and better staffed to handle this kind of trial. And so that was given the okay. Stearns and Fliss were told that they were going to be given the task of doing the actual arrest, which seems appropriate since they were the ones that had put in all of that time. A day was chosen in early March of 1973. And when the police arrived to arrest Joe, there was a note on the outside of his door that said, mother, don't you come in. I will already be dead. You just call the police or whatever. It really said or whatever. Now, back at this time, Joe Scalero had his own office. He was still trying to do sales, but he was also basically a grifter. And his mother was his secretary, and she had gone to lunch. So this is the note on the outside door that greeted detectives when they arrived to arrest him. They went into his inner office, and they found Joe Scalero dead by his own hand. The gun he used was a 25 caliber Beretta, not the weapon that killed the Robisons, but its twin. And he left a typed suicide note in his office where he discussed all of the people that he owed money to. And that was typewritten. And then in a PS at the bottom of the note, it said, "Oh, by the way, I did not kill the Robisons. I'm a liar, a cheat, and a phony, but not a murderer."
Was he tipped off to the fact that the police were coming, assumably?
Yeah, his mom had friends in the prosecutor's office, and they said to her, "Hey, sorry to deliver you this difficult news, but your son's about to be arrested." And so she shared that with him. So he knew it was coming. But it just, I mean, it's a punch in the gut that at least he couldn't have come clean in the note.
Right, right. Yeah. Very cowardly not to admit what he had done.
Yeah, when I'm asked about that, they say, well, why wouldn't he tell the truth? And what did it matter then? And on the one hand, I think that his last supporter was his mother. And I think he couldn't bear to have her know what he had done. But the other part of me reads that note again, and the very first word that he uses to describe himself is liar. So I guess I just choose to believe him in that part of his self-description.
And it was easy to come clean about the financial issues because people were going to find out about them anyway.
Right. Right. Yeah.
The co-ed murders were happening in Michigan around this time, right?
Yeah, Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti, yeah.
Do you think there was any connection at all between the co-ed murders and the Robison murders?
I don't. The connection that has tried to have been made is that the guy who was arrested, tried, convicted, and is still in prison for being the co-ed killer was at CMU or at college about the same time that Richie was. And it's possible that they went to the same orientation. So with that just little grain of possibility, people have suggested that, you know, how could these two heinous crimes not be related? But the co-ed killer was all young women. And this was an entire family financially motivated. So even though they're both just unthinkably terrible crimes and they both happened in the same state, they were far apart and with a completely different MO.
There was sexual assault involved in the co-ed murders, right?
Yes.
And not in the case of the Robisons.
No, they never were able to prove anybody was sexually assaulted. Shirley may have been posed to make it look like she had been sexually assaulted, but they years after years went by, they eventually got a grant to do some DNA testing when DNA became available, and there was nothing to test. They didn't, you know, there wasn't anything there. So the present day thinking is that she was not sexually abused.
You write in your book that in the last 40 years, this case has passed through multiple Michigan State Police detectives, Emmett County sheriffs, undersheriffs, sheriff's office detectives, the state attorney general's office, and four Emmett County prosecutors. Where does the case sit now? Is it on anyone's radar at all?
Now it is officially still open, but it is cold. I think there's an accepted agreement that Joe Scalero was the guilty person. There are some people who question whether he had help. I'm not one of those people. But it's difficult to close a case when your main suspect committed suicide and didn't come clean in the suicide note. I think the closest thing to closure that I've seen or I've felt or the family members that I've spoken with have felt was that program with the detectives, you know, was the assurance that they got from the detectives that they were positive that Joe was guilty. They had done everything that they could possibly do to get him arrested, and that didn't happen, but it certainly was through no fault of their own. So if there is any closure to be had in this case, it's the memories of the detectives and the prosecutors who worked on it.
What is the argument made for him having an accomplice in this?
From what I've heard, it's that how could one person take six people by surprise? Well, imagine that you are the person in that cottage and you are with your family. You're on vacation. You're getting ready to go on a trip. The very last thing that you're thinking about is any kind of conflict. You have no idea that somebody's going to shoot at you from outside. And so the idea that one person could not have committed this crime, I think, is ludicrous. There would have been pandemonium inside of that cabin, and one person very well could have, and did, as far as I'm concerned, commit the crime.
So how do you think he did this? Could you walk us through how you think he committed the murders?
Well, the police proved that Richard was shot first, so that he took out the main threat first, then Shirley, and then Richie Jr. So those were the three adults. Those were the three ones that could possibly challenge him, and those were the ones who were shot with the .22 through the window. And then he came in the back door with a loaded Beretta and finished off the rest of the family.
And then he left the note on the car, right?
Left the note on the door. The door. Yeah.
Were they able to verify it was his handwriting on the note?
They were not. They did take a look at it, but it was on a paper towel and it was a marker. The only thing curious about that is whoever wrote the note spelled Robinson wrong. So, you know, it wasn't written by any of the family members. They would have spelled their own last name the right way, but they couldn't. You know, the handwriting was too scraggly to really match it or not match it to anyone's regular handwriting.
So in the 11 years or so since your book first came out, has there been any new information you can share with us?
Right. So a couple of pieces of new, not necessarily new information, but the first is that there are tape recordings of Joe being interviewed by police on those interviews that he gave. And I think it'd be interesting to put those tape recorders through voice analysis and see if any new information could be gleaned from that. The other thing that happened about maybe a few weeks after the book was published, and this is the kind of thing that just kills an author, because you want to put this sort of thing in the book. You don't want to learn it after you're finished writing it. But I was on a live radio program here in Northern Michigan, and unbeknownst to me, the host said, "Now let's open it up to callers." And I was a little taken aback, but I was game. And I took a few calls, and then someone called and he said, "I was the chief polygraph examiner for the Michigan State Police, and I had Joe Scalero hooked up to my apparatus three times." And he said, "I have something to tell you, but I'm not going to say it on the air." So this was a guy I had been trying to track down when I was doing my research, and I couldn't find him. And it turned out here he lived right up here in Northern Michigan. So we got together for coffee the next day, and he told me this story. He said, "After I retired, pretty much all I did was fish. I lived on the lake, and I was down at the lake one day, and the phone rang, and my son answered it. And the man on the other end of the line said, 'Tell your dad he was right.' And the kid said, 'Well, you know, he's just down at the lake. I'm happy to go get him for you. Just hold on.' And the guy said, 'No, I don't need to talk to him. Just give him the message. Tell him that Joe called and he was right. Your dad was right.' And then the caller hung up. So when the polygraph examiner, his name was Ed Goss, when he came up from the lake, his son said, 'Hey, Dad, a guy named Joe called, and he said to tell you that you were right.' Well, Ed wasn't sure who his son was talking about. I don't know if Joe Scalero immediately came to mind, but he figured that out within a few hours because that was the day Joe Scalero killed himself. So while Joe was hooked up to Ed Goss's apparatus, as he called it, one of the things that Ed said to him was, Joe, you're a Catholic boy. I'm a Catholic boy. You're not going to be able to live with yourself that you did this unless you confess. Just tell somebody. And if you're not going to tell me, then tell your priest. And Joe just kind of, you know, sloughed it off. So Ed's thinking is that the caller was Joe Scalero and that that was the closest that he would ever get to a confession. Now, I would have loved to have put that scene in the book, but I didn't learn it until afterwards. But it certainly just underscores my feeling and the detective's feelings that Joe was responsible.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't sound like there is any question at all of his guilt.
No.
Well, thanks so much for coming on and sharing this. Are you working on anything new?
Yeah, I am. I'm working on a case from October of 1900. And it's this will be my first case, though, that isn't a murder. So on October 15th of 1900, an entire village of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians was burned to the ground on the shore of Burt Lake. A crooked sheriff and a wealthy lumber baron decided that this was land that they wanted. So I'm looking into why and how that was able to happen. There were some of the villagers that ended up passing away because of the stress and the that happened afterwards. But it's not a murder. It's more of a, I suppose it's more of a bureaucratic and also just in historic injustice. So it's really interesting. I'm finding the research just fascinating.
Oh, excellent. I can't wait for it to come out. That's all you can really ask for is to find a topic that you're truly passionate about, like you said at the beginning of our chat.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you again for your time.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me back.
Again, I've been speaking to Marty Link. Her book is called When Evil Came to Good Heart, an Up North Michigan Cold Case. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day, there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. So listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.